The Shaq Show is a production of iHeartRadio. Today on The Shaq Show, the PGA Tour is back, and we're going to talk Colonial with Gil Hanse. Well, a lot of the focus this week is the tour returns to action at Fort Worth, at Colonial. We'll be on the players, their safety, how it all works, no crowds, how television manages what is going to be a very complicated task. We heard all about it today on a conference call with CBS, and it is, needless to say, a very difficult task they are attempting to undertake and make entertaining for us. But most golf fans are just happy to watch some golf. But probably forgotten in all this will be Colonial Country Club, the historic annual stop on the PGA Tour, now known as the Charles Schwab Challenge. And to discuss Colonial, I managed, after a lot of wrangling with his extensive publicity team, to secure architect Gil Hanse, who has been hired by the club to commission a master plan. Of course, if you know much about golf, you know he is the architect of several world-class courses since he began his firm in 1993. Places like Castle Stewart, which hosted several Scottish Opens, Boston Golf Club, Ohoopee Match Club, Streamsong Black, Mossy Oak, Rustic Canyon, which I had the privilege of working with him on, and, of course, most famously, the Olympic course in Rio. Then there are the renovations, the overhaul of Pinehurst No. 4, Doral's Blue Monster. There are the par 3 courses, the Prairie Club's horse course, which I also got to work with Gil and Jim Wagner on, and maybe most beloved of maybe any course Gil's designed, based on the feedback I hear, the Cradle at Pinehurst. And it does look like a blast. But it's his restoration resume that is just truly astounding. And it's even more astounding when you think of how many crazy member suggestions he must have listened to over the years. But just listen to these names. These are just some of the places that Gil has done restoration work at. Plainfield, Ridgewood, The Creek, Fisher's Island, Sleepy Hollow, West Hampton, Palmetto, Tokyo Golf Club, Marion, the Country Club, Wingfoot, and Los Angeles Country Club's North Course, where they will be hosting the 2023 U.S. Open, and another project I work with Gil on. Now, he's going forward with more of this incredible restoration work and undertaking two big ones and American classic brand names, Baltus Roll and Oakland Hills, which have, let's just be honest, have fallen out of favor a little bit. And I think a restoration will be very exciting at both of those places. And, of course, he is continuing work on the new course in Frisco, Texas for the PGA of America. And nearby Frisco is, of course, Colonial Country Club, the historic place that was generally considered one of America's great courses for a very long time. Hogan's Alley. Ben Hogan won 5 Colonials there. A place we've gotten to know on television, but has fallen to 155th in the Golf Digest ranking. Not that the panelists always get it right, but something has occurred. There have been a lot of changes over the years. There was a flood in 1949. So I wanted to talk to Gil about Colonial, what he's learned in researching the history of the course, how it could be better, what we should be watching for this week when the PGA Tour returns to action in Fort Worth at Colonial. Here's my chat with Gil Hanse. So, Gil, where are you today and what'd you work on today?
I am at Baltus Roll Golf Club, Springfield, New Jersey. We're we're restoring the golf course. So I was working today with Kevin Murphy and Jeff Stein on the 10th green, getting all the expansions done on it and getting it all ready. And they're actually, we're scanning it just a little bit ago so that we've got our blueprint for when they dig it up and core it out and put in all the fancy stuff underneath it, they know what to put back.
Very nice. Now, this week, the tour is moving to or returning to golf, and it's showing up at Colonial where it has annually for a very long time. And I was hoping you could kind of help us better understand a course that we've gotten used to seeing on TV, but we know there's some changes over the years, and they had a project in 2008 that Keith Foster worked on. So can you just give us a little background on why you were hired and how that happened, and then maybe we'll talk a little bit about the course?
Sure. We were approached about 4 or 5 years ago to talk to the club about moving forward. I think they had mutually decided to part ways with Keith Foster, and I think he was completely fine with that. And it was really to look at how could we historically figure out what happened at Colonial and how it evolved to the point where it is now. And in so doing, it's a long history, and there's many, many characters who are involved in it, which is, you know, most people think it's a Perry Maxwell golf course, but he had his hands in it in preparation for the 1941 U.S. Open. And but it was John Breedemus before him, and then it was Maxwell, and then it was Ralph Plummer, and then Dick Wilson and Ben Hogan.
Oh, wow.
Worked on it together. Then I think Floyd Farley had a hand in it. And I think then there were a few other people, maybe Robert Trent Jones Sr. and eventually to Keith Foster. So I think we're like number 8 or 9 on the list of golf course architects who've been involved there. And so really what we tried to do is just piece together how everything evolved over time. And I think Maxwell's contributions were significant, but they're gone for the most part. I mean, he routed holes 3, 4, and 5, the horrible horseshoe, which, are just an amazing set of golf holes and very, very difficult and really the key part of the golf course. But a lot of the feature work that he did and the greens that he constructed were rebuilt over a period of time, some of them several times. And, a lot of them were much lower to the ground, really very, very lay of the land architecture. And so I think trying to figure all that out. And then in the 1960s, you had, a flood control program that was put in place to harness the Trinity River. And they lost two of the most spectacular holes on the property, both par threes, number 8, which had their played with the river kind of cutting across and along the right-hand side. And then number 13, where an arm of the river kind of bowed around and went in front of the green. So those holes were lost and moved inland, and the channel, the Trinity River, was sort of straightened out. And then a lot of other flood control measures on the back 9 primarily. So it's had a lot of nips and tucks, and our hope is that we can decipher how all of it came together, try to let the membership know or understand that a little bit better, and then put together a plan that will hopefully return a lot of the real character of the golf course.
Is there a sense, like a lot of the places that you have done restoration work at, that it's missing something, that there was a point, a high point for the course, and that there's a certain time that you'd like to kind of aim for trying to get back if people all agree that was a good time?
Yeah, I think everything focuses around that U.S. Open. I had the great good fortune to sit down with Marty Leonard, who's the daughter of Marvin Leonard, the founder of Colonial, and Dan Jenkins, the late great Dan Jenkins, and to just listen to the two of them talk about the golf course and talk about, it's very similar to the work that we've done together at Los Angeles Country Club, where there was just this rustic, beautiful patina that has evolved into a much more polished and refined look to it. It was scruffy and a little bit ragged, and there were some dry washes that weave their way through the property, and the greens sat much lower to the ground, as I mentioned. And Dan Jenkins said it was a dark golf course. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, there were trees all over the place, and you were hitting into what felt like tunnels, and the greens sat down on the ground. So the trees really felt like they were overhanging everything, and because the features were much lower profile, and it was just a great, great lunch and a great, I had never spent much time around him, and obviously you know him well or knew him well, and what character he was and some of the descriptions he had of the golf course. So I think when you look at the photos and the character and the scale from those early years. This golf course was built during the Depression. So, it was very young when it hosted the U.S. Open. I think that's the heyday. And I think that's the look and feel we'd really like to restore to the property.
Did he give you much of a sense of Hogan's view of the place? Cause he and I used to discuss, it just drove him nuts that Hogan referred to Riviera before the flood. He would always tell him Riviera before the flood was one of his top five courses. And so even though after I've explained to Dan what happened with the flood, he's just refused to believe it because Hogan couldn't have played the course before the flood. And I then tried to say, well, Dan, somebody might have explained how it used to play and those holes bother him. And he understood why those holes were better at one time. Anyway, we never resolved that argument. But I was grateful that he always brought it up. It bugged him. But with Colonial, did you go into that at all? Cause obviously Hogan is such a big part of their history.
We did, and he did play it before the flood, before the big
yeah. They had a flood too, events. So yeah,
yeah. So he did know it well, and Dan said that that Hogan was just locked in at that golf course. He knew every blade of grass. He played there a lot. He was then, as I mentioned, I think involved in some of the architectural changes with Dick Wilson. And I think ultimately, there seemed to have been, and Marty Leonard concurred that there was some sort of falling out between him and Marvin Leonard, which made him go over to Shady Oaks and found that. And so it was, but no, he had great success there and he had a great respect for the golf course. And, that we talk about, shot makers golf course, and, maybe that's a little bit trite in this day and age, but, with him, obviously the ultimate shot maker and the ability to do whatever he wanted with a golf ball. He loved the precise nature of Colonial, the fact that it was tree line and you had to hit quality shots to get your ball around that golf course. And that still is the case today on a golf course that's considered short for today's tour. And generally the thing that strikes you when you get there is you look at that wall of champions and so many good players on that wall. I mean, it would be something that any place would be really proud to show off.
We're going to take a quick break on the Shaq Show, but I'm curious. You just made me think about something regarding golf architecture and great winners, and I want to ask you about that when we come back. All right, we're back. So do you buy that notion that great architecture produces great champions in general?
I do. I think that there's a certain level of golfer that rises to the occasion, to the test at hand, and great golf courses, I think, tend to provide that. I mean, obviously, you're going to have guys that just get hot for a week, but I think over the course of time, courses that have hosted multiple championships, generally the great ones have a really strong winners board on it. And I think that that's really important. And I know that's something that Jim Wagner and I talk a lot about, is that, people always ask, oh, are you, what do you want the winning score to be if it's on a golf course that we've designed? It's like, we really don't care. We'd love to have a great winner. if you get a really good winner on your golf course, then I think that somehow validates the quality of the course, the architecture, et cetera. And I think in the Olympics, down in Rio, we had, both on the men and the women's side, just great winners, great medalists, everything about. And I think that's something that Jim and I really are proud of if we can get great winners on our courses. So not that we're building great courses, but I think it's just to get to that sort of level of, hey, if the guys that win there are good, I think that does validate. I mean, working here at Baltusrol, had one of the most fun, things working on the 18th fairway and, running a bulldozer around Jack Nicklaus's plaque, sitting in the middle of the fairway and trying not to hit it and making sure that we took great care of getting it out of the ground. And, and you see the plaques here and you see the winners that, obviously Nicklaus winning here twice. It's, that helps certainly to validate the architecture, in my opinion.
Since you've been doing this, have you seen a shift? Because I know when you started, and I started getting interested in architecture, so much was centered around scoring and evaluating a tournament and a course based on the scoring. Have you seen a shift in people being less obsessed with that idea? Or is it still there?
I think it's still there for members at clubs that host tournaments.
Yeah,
they don't want the perception that their golf course is easy, but the reality is that the players today and the way they play the game of golf. We're right now talking about a new normal, obviously, with the pandemic and with what's going on in our country. But I think the reality of the new normal for golf is that major championships are going to be won with double digit under par. That's just got to be, you know, throwing out whether it's the U.S. Open, the Open Championship, the Masters, you know, PGA, that's just going to be the new standard. The level of golf that's being played, the distance they're hitting it, the level of maintenance that's being presented to these players. I mean, unless they get something out of the ordinary weather-wise, I think that standard is just going to have to be applied. And it doesn't in any, or shouldn't in any way, shape, or form diminish people's perception of the quality of a golf course. I remember back to when we redid Doral and J.D. Holmes went out and shot 62, and some people were very upset.
I wonder
about
who.
That. Hmm. Yeah, exactly. But Johnny Miller on the broadcast said something that I'll never forget. He said, "Listen, great golf courses yield great scores when players are playing at an extremely high level. If a guy's playing it or a woman's playing at such a high level and the golf course still won't yield a good score, then there's probably something wrong with the golf course."
Yeah.
And so I think that, it's just, there's always going to be this ego. There's always going to be this pride of, people at their clubs or their facilities wanting to their golf course to appear to be a good enough test for these guys. But unless you get wind and dry, firm conditions, they're going to shoot good scores because they're just that good. And I think that we just have to apply that new normal, that new standard to what winning scores are going to be.
I've had success in arguing that with people that to focus on the disparity or the spread of the scores, to get them off of obsessing about that low number, and then seeing if a course indeed kind of spread out the field and weeded people out, that actually is a greater statement about that it rewarded good play, but it also kind of beat somebody up who was not on their game.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're looking at like when Rory won at Congressional, or Gary Woodland at Pebble Beach. He was the only one, I think, double digits under par. So people might look at that and go, "Oh, okay, you're 12 under one, the U.S. Open." Well, actually, he played really great golf, yeah. And it was three other guys that were anywhere close. And you're right; I think that's the case. Whereas Aaron Hills, where there were just 100 guys, a lot of guys under par, and it was a different type of tournament. So I think you're right in that sort of. The spread in the scoring. If somebody plays exceptional golf, the golf course should yield a score to that.
Yeah. So you are in the midst of presenting this master plan to the members. The tour will be back this week. You will not be able to be there, but tell us a little bit about what you'll either look for when you're maybe watching the replay on Golf Channel in the evening or on the weekend and relaxing or afterwards when, maybe Steve Wensloff will provide you with ShotLink data. What are the things that you're watching for at Colonial this week?
It's a golf course that most players, there's only going to be a few holes where they're going to hit driver. So it's mainly going to be fairway metals and even driving irons off of the tee. So I think it'll be interesting to watch how, the longer hitters navigate their way around the golf course itself. A big part of this master plan that we're hopeful to present this fall is going to be, an agronomic piece, which I know you're very familiar with, and these clubs sort of upgrading their ability to grow grass in tough growing conditions. So Scott Ebers, the golf course superintendent, does a great job down there, but trying to grow bent grass in this time of year in particular, a couple weeks after when they normally have the tournament, I'm hopeful that the golf course conditioning will hold up, because that's a lot of what we're talking about. Growing bent grass in Texas is not, as I said, not easy. And there are tools that can help that. So I think we'll be looking at the conditioning of the golf course and how, hopefully what we're proposing will help that long term. And then, the putting. The one thing about Colonial that's interesting is that now that the greens are up, most of them are set up above the grade and, you know, with deeper bunkers in and around them, is the approach play. I think I'm always curious to see how many guys hit greens when they're perched up like that. And especially since we're talking about lowering a lot of them and putting them for it closer to the ground. So I'll be kind of curious to watch the approach play into them. And then like you and like everybody else who listens to this, I'm just happy to have golf back. I mean, it's going to be fun to watch. It's going to be different. It's going to be interesting, but I think it's, you know, for all of us, it's going to be a wonderful distraction to have some, you know, have meaningful live sports again.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I listened to the call today with Sean McManus and Jim Nance and Nick Faldo. They're going to have a drone, they think. They're fine tuning it, but they're probably going to have a drone out there because there are no people. So they're going to mimic Fox a little bit on the live drone. So you may get some different views of Colonial. Just quickly, the bentgrass thing, is that sort of a part of the history? Marvin Leonard was big on bentgrass, I read somewhere. Is that part of the reason of sticking with it?
Yep, that's absolutely correct. It was his legacy, and obviously as the founder of the club. The club, you know, takes it very importantly that, you know, his contributions to the place and his legacy. I think they felt very strongly, given the opportunities that present themselves now, you know, with hydronics and with the ability to work with soil temperatures and obviously new greens mix, et cetera, I think will give them a really good chance to have finely conditioned turf, you know, even during the height of the summer.
And one last Colonial question. Is there any ability to, you mentioned seeing where they're going to be approaching from, all that kind of stuff. Is there any ability to get driver in their hands a little bit more to bring back some of the things that Hogan loved about it in that sense?
There's a few spots where we're going to be able to lengthen a couple holes, but it's pretty well maxed out. Yeah. So, you know, there are a few things that were done in the most recent renovation to the golf course that I think tried to tighten up the landing zones, and they, you know, adding some bunkers that were not part of the original design. We're proposing to take some of those out so that, you know, the penalty is much more just the rough and the trees. And so maybe that'll allow golfers, you know, the tour players to feel a little bit freer off the tee and maybe take driver.
Okay, one more break, and then I have a little bit of a bone to pick with Gil about something that had just popped up on the internet. We'll be right back on The Shack Show. All right, Gil, so Golf Magazine / golf.com posted something online yesterday, your top 10. I assume it was written in January in your beautiful handwriting. Your top 10 courses in the world. And it's a, was this part of their ranking? Is that why they asked you that? I think you're a panelist there, I believe.
Yeah, I'm a panelist. And I think they just said different parts of the year, they're just going to ask some different panelists to throw out their top 10. And first question by Rand Morissette was, are you willing to do this? And I thought, well, yeah. I mean, I don't think I'm going to make anybody mad, but apparently I've upset you.
So. Not upset. I just have a question. Well, it's a fantastic list. It starts what I love, of course, that you did, which I think is the perfect way to do this. You start with number one, the Old Course, number two, National, and then you draw a line, and the rest are just alphabetical. But those two are on another level, another plane. They're, at least to us in who study golf architecture, they're the kind of the ultimate cathedrals. So then you have a Chicago Golf Club, LA Country Club. This is an alphabetical order. Marion, Muirfield, Pine Valley, Royal County Down, Royal Melbourne West. All amazing courses. All places that people should drop everything they're doing if they get the chance to play if they're not a member. But can you guess which one kind of surprised me a little bit, just knowing your style of design? And by the way, very nice that you didn't mention one of your own courses. Like, that really confirmed you're not a member of the Jones family. But any one on the list you think that I
didn't
might?
Didn't have Cypress Point.
Oh, it's Cypress Point. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes,
okay,
I forgot.
Good. I was like, wait a second.
I skipped over that. Sorry. Out. That's right before Chicago Golf Club.
Which one you wouldn't like out of that list?
I wouldn't like. I just wonder why, of all the places in that region, would you pick that one? Okay, Muirfield.
Realfield, absolutely. Yeah, that was just that was one of. So I played there recently, and I there was something about it that I've forgotten and remembered just how. You know, it's not dramatic. It's certainly not the most dramatic links out there, but the bunkering is such, and I think it's you know, what old Tom Moore's the old water meaty. You know, just the I love the feel of that place. There's just something about it that it's magical to me. And trust me, where would I rather play? Probably North Berwick, which is just down the road.
And that's why I asked. Yeah.
Yeah. But, it's that whole sort of, argument that discussion that we have is, all right, I understand that Shinnecock Hills is probably a quote unquote better test of golf, but I'd rather play at National. I understand that, I think Muirfield is probably that better test of golf. I would rather play at North Berwick.
Yeah.
But I also was thinking, all right, how do we stack it? So, yeah.
Well, it is. I'd put Dornick. There's several others I'd put ahead of it.
Yeah. Where would you, so, what? Which ones would you throw out? What would you
North?
Out?
Well, North Berwick. Oh, that's the only one I'd throw off the list. And it's fantastic. And in fact, well, we'll get to. But I another argument about it. But I don't know if you've seen Turnberry since Martin Ebert redid it, but
I have not.
I put that ahead of it. Carnoustie, I really kind of fell in love with again seeing it at the Open. I'd forgotten some things. I forgot. I don't know if I'd want to play it every day. I'd rather go to Panmure. But Cruden Bay, I love. Prestwick, I've just come to really love. Dornick and North Berwick are the two that I feel like, or more you. But that was just my reaction. But the par threes at Muirfield, I think you and I have discussed that the set at Los Angeles Country Club is as good a set of par threes on the planet, and I think people will see that when they have the U.S. Open. But Muirfields are pretty incredible.
I agree.
You would get a kick out of this. I was doing a Golf World preview story on Muirfield before the 2013 Open, and I was at the memorial, and Jack Nicklaus does this great session where he just kind of everybody gathers around him and people just sort of throw out things that they're working on for various tournaments. And I was doing a story on how all the par threes are uphill at Muirfield, and you love uphill par threes, I know. And most of the best par threes in the world are either flat or uphill. And so I threw it out at him. I said, doing this story, and he immediately shot it down. No, they're not. And then he paused. And he went, okay, well, let's go with number four. And then he proceeded to go through them, and all these riders are sitting there, of course, just going, oh, who cares about uphill? But then as he kept going through it, and he had to admit, okay, well, yeah. They are all kind of a little bit up. And then some writer chimed in from the local paper with a question. He went, no, I'm not done yet. And all the writers then really perked up, and he proceeded to just kind of go through them and what he loved about those holes but why he likes a little more visibility at his par threes. And then, of course, classic Jack at the end, he goes, did you get what you need? And you're like, you just went for 5 minutes on par threes. Of course, yes, you did very well. Thank you, Mr. Nicklaus. So, but they are a great set of par threes there. They really are.
Yeah, I agree.
So, all right. Well, that was all. I just wanted to get some clarity on that. And a very important first world matter here. So,
of course.
Thank you so much for kind of prepping us. I mean, we're all, like you said, we're all excited about the watching some golf again. But I think it's a course that we all have kind of scratched our head at. Television doesn't do certain things justice. And also sort of knowing its history will be interesting to see. I hope you get to do a lot of things that bring back a little more of that charm.
Well, I hope so as well. We're really excited about it. I think, we're looking forward to getting in front of the members and hopefully get them excited about it as well. And it isn't lost on me. And I think it's kind of cool that, aside from Riviera, Colonial's probably the most, the longest term course on tour, and it's got obviously a tremendous tournament history. And so it's kind of cool that they're going back. They're starting off at one of these great old courses that we're all familiar with, that we all have memories of watching on TV and I think that that's a great way to get the tour back. And obviously they've got a phenomenal field. So I'm sure the folks in Fort Worth at Colonial are really excited about that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thank you so much, Gil.
You're welcome, Jeff. Always good talking to you.
All right. Thanks again to Gil Hance for appearing here on The Shack Show and sharing some of his insights into Colonial. It should be a fun week. We will cover it. We will analyze it on jeffshackelford.com. It's me. And of course, if you have any feedback about the show, don't hesitate to contact me there or write a nice review on iTunes is always a good thing, or just give it a nice rating there. That seems to still matter, or just listen to it on the iHeartRadio app. And by the way, The Shack Show, just so you know, is produced by Tim Prochka and is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeart, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. So until next time, please be safe and thank you for listening. And I will be back soon.